From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Linda McCarriston's latest book is filled with poems that teachers and friends urged her not to write. Angry poems about how her father sexually abused her and her mother. On today's Fresh Air, McCarriston reads and discusses some very disturbing poems. Later, we'll compare the movie portrayals of Bugsy Siegel and Meyer Lansky to the real gangsters, with Robert Lacey, author of a biography of Lansky. And rock historian Ed Ward tells an important story in the history of black-owned record labels, the story of Bobby Robinson, who ran the Red Robin, Whirlin' Disc, Fire, Fury, and Enjoy labels. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Mainstream political parties in France, which failed to win a clear majority in Sunday's elections for regional council, have started courting small protest parties in hopes of forming coalitions. From Paris, Lynn Terry reports.
The election fractured French politics and has left few of France's 22 regional councils governable in the view of many observers. The ruling socialists got less than 20% of the vote, while mainstream conservative parties scored about 33%. About a third of French voters chose extreme right-wing or environmentalist candidates. These small parties have a swing vote in many regions and could determine who's elected president of the councils when politicians cast their votes on Friday. Conservatives have started wooing the environmentalists in hopes of forming coalitions with them. Mainstream right-wing candidates have said they won't form alliances with the extreme right, but in some regions, they could be forced to do just that. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
The Federal Reserve has approved a merger between Bank America Corporation and Security Pacific. The merger is the largest in American banking history. The bank that will result will be the second largest in the country, with around $190 billion in assets and hundreds of branches in 10 western states and Hawaii. Today's ruling from the Fed is the last major regulatory hurdle to the deal. Before approving the merger, the Fed demanded that the banks agree to meet lending goals in poor neighborhoods and divest some branch banks to avoid potential antitrust problems. The Prime Minister of Turkey has called on the Turkish people to reject what he called the madness of violence in the southeast portion of the country. More than 50 people have been killed in several days of clashes between Kurdish separatists and the security forces. From Ankara, the BBC's Jonathan Rugman reports.
Police on duty this weekend were under strict orders not to be provoked by crowds looking for a fight. And there's no doubt that Kurdish militants did fire upon the security forces. But questions of who fired first are difficult to answer. In Cizre, guerrillas of the Kurdish Workers' Party, or PKK, have again attacked a police station. The semi-official Anatolia news agency has reported that a Turkish journalist covering the fighting has been killed in the town. A senior official in the region said the town of Şırnak, near the Iraqi border, was not under full government control. A Turkish television station quoted the wife of a policeman in the town as saying that police residences had been surrounded by guerrillas, with 200 women and children inside, while the police were trying to fend off the attackers with dwindling supplies of ammunition.
The BBC's Jonathan Rugman. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 4 points to close at 3,272. Declines led advances by a margin of about 3-2 in moderate trading. This is NPR News. Kuwaiti officials said today that they'll resume trying people suspected of collaborating with the Iraqi army during the occupation of Kuwait. The Emirates' head prosecutor said 33 cases will be tried next month in the state security courts. A single case can involve more than 5 defendants. The first round of collaboration trials took place shortly after the end of the Gulf War, when Kuwait was still under martial law. Those trials were criticized by international human rights groups and Kuwaiti defense lawyers, who accused the prosecutors of using coerced confessions and insufficient evidence. There's still no end in sight to the transit strike in Pittsburgh, which entered its second week today. The strike has forced 285,000 commuters to find alternate transportation. Kevin Gavin of member station WDUQ reports.
There has had been hope of a breakthrough in today's negotiations between the Port Authority Transit and the Amalgamated Transit Workers Union, which represents 2,700 striking bus and subway operators and mechanics. The two sides met for 4 hours today, presenting counteroffers to proposals offered at the last bargaining session. But state mediator William McCann says the union feels today's offer by management is worse than the previous one. McCann says the two sides are at a total impasse, and neither management nor the union is showing the sense of urgency that he says exists to reach a settlement. The two sides ignored a plea by Pennsylvania Governor Bob Casey to bargain around the clock to resolve the dispute. No further talks are scheduled. For National Public Radio, I'm Kevin Gavin in Pittsburgh.
Six people were reported killed today in a gun battle between Lebanese police and Syrian occupation forces in Beirut. It was said to be the most serious clash between the two forces since the Syrian army moved into the area in 1987. The Syrian army has about 40,000 troops in Lebanon under an Arab League mandate. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The poems in Linda McCarriston's latest book, Eva Mary, are so personal and so disturbing, she had been cautioned against writing and publishing them. The subject of this book is how her father sexually and physically abused her and her mother. The book won the 1991 Terence DePré Prize for Poetry, an award named in honor of the late author, who is best known for his study of life in Hitler's death camps. It was also nominated for a National Book Award. Eva Mary is McCarriston's second collection of poems. McCarriston grew up outside of Boston in a working-class tenement. She now lives in Vermont. This is the first poem she wrote about her father's abuse. She told me she wrote it to directly address the institutional powers that have turned their backs on domestic violence. Here's Linda McCarriston.
To Judge Phelan, dead long enough, a summons. Your Honor, when my mother stood before you with her routine domestic plea, after weeks of waiting for speech to return to her body, with her homemade 40s hairdo, her face purple still under pancake, her jaw off just a little, her holy of holies healing, her breasts wrung, her heart, the bursting heart of someone snagged among rocks deep in a shark pool. No, not someone, but a woman there, snagged with her babies, by them, in one of hope's pedestrian, brutal turns. When, in the tones of parlors overlooking the harbor, you admonished that, for the sake of the family, the wife must take the husband back to her bed. What you willed not to see before you was a woman risen clean to the surface, a woman who, with one arm flailing, held up with the other her actual burdens of flesh. When you clamped to her leg the chain of justice, you ferried us back down to the law, the black ice eye, the maw, the mako that circles the kitchen table nightly. What did you make of the words she told you not to have heard her, not to have seen her there? Almost forgivable ignorance, you were not the fist, the boot, or the blade, but the jaded, corrective ear and eye at the limits of her world. Now I will you to see her as she was, to ride your own words back into light. I call your spirit home again, divesting you of robe and bench, the fine white hand and half-lit Irish eye. Tonight, put on a body in the trailer down the road, where your father, when he can't get it up, makes love to your mother with a rifle. Let your name be Eva Mary. Let your hour of birth be dawn. Let your life be long and common, and your flesh endure.
That's Linda McCarriston reading a poem from her new collection, Eva Mary. Were you at this trial that your mother was at? I'm assuming that this is based on an incident that really happened to you.
No, this is actually when I was very, very young, and I was not there. And this is drawn from her recounting of her efforts to divorce my father, to leave him, and going before this particular judge in these conditions, and having this particular judge tell her that the judge was an Irish Catholic, my father was an Irish Catholic, and the family mattered most of all, and she was to go back home.
Linda, this book is almost all about sexual and physical abuse, and reading it, I thought, well, that you might be just consumed by these feelings and perhaps thought of nothing else. Now, I was just looking through your first book of poems, published in 1984, and they have a completely different tone. They're poems about love and children and animals. I mean, there's both joy and pain in the books. When did you start writing the series of poems about abuse that are collected in your new book?
Many of my teachers who felt that I was potentially a good writer felt that it would damage my hope of success if I insisted on writing this work, and really encouraged me to write the other poems, the poems that were more allusive. I think much of the emotional content of the first book is very much the same as the second book. I think the second book has a great deal of love in it. It simply shows through to the grief and outrage. And the poems that actually comprise the second book were being written, beginning to be written, by the end of the first book, which was about 84. I wrote them and put them away. I really did not share them with anyone because they were very frightening to me, frightening to imagine my sharing with anyone. And I can remember the very first time that I did share this particular poem with a group of people at a reading, I simply shook the entire time I read it, not with anger or hatred, but with fear. I shook with fear that some man in the audience would rise up and shoot me. I shook with fear because my father at that point was still alive, and I thought he would hear of it and come to me and shoot me. I really did. I wrote these poems with a great deal of fear.
Did your father ever find out about the poems?
They were published in Boston before his death, and he never made... By that time, I no longer had a connection with my father. I don't believe he would have seen these poems. He would not have been likely to read them.
What about your mother? Because by you making a public statement about this, you were making a public statement about her life, too.
She actually has been very supportive of this work. And I don't know if you can, I don't know what kinds of obscenity you can say on the air. I don't know if I can quote her. But she said, I knew I didn't go through all that blank for nothing. She said, I knew I didn't go through all that blank for nothing. I knew there was some reason for that suffering. And she felt that if I could make this use of that suffering, she was willing to have me do it, and she has never objected to these poems. Partly, of course, they really valorize her life, which I think deserves valorization.
If you're just joining us, my guest is poet Linda McCarriston. There's another poem I want you to read now, and it's called Hotel Nights with My Mother.
There was a particular hotel in Lynn, Massachusetts, that we would run to when there really were no more relatives that we could run to, and my mother could continue to save face. This is a poem about it. Hotel Nights with My Mother. The hometown flophouse was what she could afford the nights he came after us with a knife. I'd grab my books, already dreading the next day's explanations of homework undone. I ran out of paper, the lies I'd invent, standing in front of the nuns in the clothes I'd lain in, full-bladdered all night, a flimsy chair-braced door between us and the hallway's impersonal riot. Years later, then, in the next city, standing before my first class, I scanned the rows of faces, their cumulative skill in the brilliant adolescent dances of self-presentation, of hiding. New teacher, looking young, seeming gullible, I know, I let them give me any excuse and took it. I was watching them all for the dark circled eyes, yesterday's crumpled costume, the marks, the sorrowful coloring of marks, the cuticles flaming and torn. I made of myself each day a chink a few might pass through unscathed.
How often did you and your mother have to flee to the flophouse to get away from your father?
Oh, my. How often? It was very regular and very frequent. I wouldn't say it was every week, but I would say it was probably every month, maybe more often than once a month.
There's a line I particularly like in your poem. I'd invent standing in front of the nuns in the clothes I'd laid in full-bladdered all night.
Mm-hmm.
Was the bathroom in the hall?
Yes.
So you couldn't get out of the room to use it because there were always fights in the hall?
Yes.
That must have made it all really particularly horrible because you can't relax and you can't sleep when you need the bathroom and you can't use it.
No, it was one of the tiny little details of this way of life, which is so minor, and yet I do remember that particularly vividly, bracing the door with a chair and hearing drunken men out in the hall fighting. At least they weren't our drunken men, and they were fighting with each other, and the bathroom was out there, and my mother was beside herself, terrified, powerless, furious, beaten, and I was there with a couple of books, whatever I could grab, and wearing the same clothes and not being able to go to the bathroom all night. And then going to school the next morning to St. Mary's High School and having to fake. Not being able to go in and say, hey, you know what I did last night? You know where I spent last night? Being ashamed, leaving that hotel in downtown Lynn and walking a very circuitous route so that I wouldn't let on that I was not coming from home. So that I wouldn't have to have the humiliation of acknowledging the situation.
The nights that you spent in this flop house, did you think, well, is my life like their lives, like the lives of everybody else who lives here? Will I end up a drunk who fights in the hall like these people do because I'm here so much?
No, I didn't. I didn't have that thought at all. There are some other poems in the book and some poems I've been working on recently in which particular moments of sanity made their way to me. Little glimmers, little images, odd things, different things. And I would attach myself to those as possibilities for a way to live, a way to be human. The chief of the ways that I attached myself to was animals, which are very important in both of my books and very important in the work I'm doing now, that there seemed to me to be a level of consistency and sanity, of dignity, of peace, predictability, of lovingness among animals that I did not experience in my human community. And so I watched animals. I tried to learn from animals. I identified with animals. I never, when I was in this particular experience, when I was in my own home, I felt that I was in the grip of something. I was homesick. I was never at home in it. It never seemed correct to me. It never seemed right or inevitable. It seemed tremendously insane, and it seemed to me that if I could simply stay alive, hunker down, hide my soul someplace, sooner or later I could get out. I could get out, and it would be different.
Poet Linda McCarriston is my guest. Her latest book of poems is called Eva Mary. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Poet Linda McCarriston is my guest. I wanted to ask you to read another poem now, and this is a poem about how your father abused you, and the poem is called A Castle in Lynn.
A castle in Lynn. In the hometown tonight, in the quiet before sleep, a man strokes himself in the darkened theater of memory. Best old remembrance, he gets to play it as slow as he needs, as his hand, savvy tart of a million reruns, plays the tune, plays the parts. Now hand is the hard bottom of the girl. Now hand is full of the full new breast. Now hand, square hand, cruel as a spade, splits the green girlwood of her body. No one can take this from him now, ever, though she is for years a mother and worn, and he is too old to force any again. His cap hangs on a peg by the door, plaid wool of an elderly working man's park bench decline. I got there before the boys did, he knows, hearing back to her pleading, back to her sobbing, to his own voice over, like his body over hers. Laughter, mocking, the elemental voice of the cock, unhearted in its own quarter. A man is king in his own castle, he can still say, having got what he wanted. In a lifetime of used ones, second hand, one girl he could spill like a shot of whiskey. The whore only he could call daughter.
I'm not sure what image I could think of that would be more horrible than imagining your father masturbating to memories of how he abused you when you were young.
It took my realizing that that was a very real possibility for me to really get mad. And again, I'm not inclined to write poems about things that I've seen expressed well elsewhere. And it seems to me that each of these poems is not only Linda McCarriston's personal experience, but it is a realization that seems to me probably pretty consistent, pretty universal as part of the web of this kind of experience.
Did your mother know that your father was sexually abusing you?
She claims not to have known. She was so beaten, so battered herself, suffered such violent domestic rape, and was working in a very arduous job in a meat room of a supermarket, wrapping meat in a refrigerator room with her face all black and blue and red and purple, and also she was keeping the food on the table. And she went to the judge, she went to the doctor, she went to the lawyer, she went to the priest, and everyone said the same thing. And I think
they said, "What, stay with your husband?"
Of course, yeah. You made your bed, you lie in it. We can't do anything about this lady. And essentially, I think at some level that she did know, and at another level, she couldn't afford to know.
Did you ever succeed in getting your father to stop at all?
Well, I did, actually. First of all, I will say that I decided when I was young that I was going to kill my father because I was the youngest in the family, and I felt I had the best chance of not going to jail. And I felt that my mother would be put in jail, and my brother, who was 7 years older than me and even more fearful of my father than I was, would be put into jail. And I really, I went into their bedroom with a knife one night. And I'm writing about that now, in fact. And my mother rose and stopped me. There was a point at which I remember getting up from my father's bed. He was being sexually abusive and then horribly physically abusive. I mean, kicking me around the floor. And just crying and crying and crying and crying and crying and crying and saying, "You can't do this to me anymore." And I don't remember whether it went on after that or whether it went on as badly or in the same ways. Eventually, it stopped. And again, I can't even remember exactly when it stopped. But I do remember asserting a certain power to him, even when I couldn't, I couldn't tell anyone. I mean, he threatened me if I told anyone. But I did assert myself to my father, and then later in life, I did write him a letter and say, "Before you die, we have a chance, either with my therapist or your priest, to discuss what happened." And he said, "It never happened. You're crazy." And then he called my mother and said, "Little girls can be very seductive. It was all her fault."
Wow.
Well, that's textbook. That's textbook abuser response.
What'd your mother say?
My mother said to him that she wished She'd killed him. And this is terrible, you know, Terry, and I... On the one hand, I feel like I'm standing here very, very naked, and I could not possibly reveal myself in this way on National Public Radio if I didn't know what I didn't know how many families share, if not exactly the same brutality, if not exactly the degree of madness, this problem.
When did you start finding books, and when did you start thinking about writing yourself?
I wrote always. My home had no books. There was not a book in my house. And when I was young, when I was alone, I would be outside in the oak trees, or I would be drawing and writing. Writing stories, writing poems, drawing pictures of horses, particularly. And I always wrote. And I think that's probably the only reason I ever got through school. I was a terrible student in every subject. I was a disturbed kid in a lot of ways. But I wrote. I always wrote. And I won all the prizes in grammar school and all the prizes in high school and all the prizes in college. But I was a working-class female, Irish Catholic working-class girl, and there was no one who really was able to say to me, you know, Linda, you could make a life as a writer.
I feel like when we end this interview now, our listeners will know a lot, and I will know a lot, or at least something of what your life was like when you were young, or at least what a small part of your life was like when you were young, but we'll know very little about who you are now. Can we just end with some sense of what your life is like now, what you've been doing?
Yes. This year I, through having set aside the funds from a National Endowment for the Arts Fellowship Grant, I have taken this year and I'm working on my writing. All of the children have grown and left the house, so I'm free for the first time in my life to live daily as a writer in a wonderful, old, cranky, big house in a little village in Vermont, where my two horses are outside the kitchen door and my two dogs and cats are inside the kitchen door. And I'm very, very happy at this moment, finally free to give my day to my work, to put my work at the center of my day. For 25 years, family concerns, children have really been the center of my day, and I've had to work in addition to that, which has meant that I've always written very much around the edges of my domestic commitment. So today, I live in Vermont. I live a very simple life. From the time I grew up in Lynn, I always wanted to live in northern New England, have a horse, and never wear anything except blue jeans. And I live quietly and independently with many friends, and presently I am really loving the first year of my life as a writer.
Well, Linda McCarriston, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very, very much, Terry, for inviting me to talk with you. It's been a pleasure.
Linda McCarriston's latest book of poems is Eva Mary. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The movie Bugsy has been nominated for 10 Academy Awards. Coming up, we compare the movie to the real stories of Bugsy Siegel and Meyer Lansky. We'll hear from Robert Lacey, author of a biography of Lansky. And rock historian Ed Ward profiles Bobby Robinson, who started some of the first black-owned record labels and helped launch the career of Gladys Knight. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Talks have been suspended over a UN Security Council resolution that would impose economic sanctions on Libya. The action came after Libya agreed to turn over two men wanted in connection with the downing of Pan Am Flight 103 to the Arab League. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
Libya's UN ambassador told reporters today his government was willing to surrender the two suspects to the Arab League. UN officials say the Arab League would then hand them over to UN Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali, who would release them to U.S. or British authorities. It's not clear when the deal would take place or under what conditions, and Western officials were reserving judgment on it today. But French officials said the deal appeared to be a sign of progress, and they said Security Council talks would be suspended while it was reviewed. France, Britain, and the U.S. have proposed a Security Council resolution that would, among other things, ban air travel to Libya. The deal announced today was arbitrated by the Arab League, which opposes sanctions. In New York, this is Jim Zaroli reporting.
A federal official says that a first evaluation of the cockpit voice recorder of a U.S. air jet that crashed last night has shed no immediate light on the cause of the crash. The jet went down while taking off from New York's LaGuardia Airport. At least 26 people of the 51 on board were killed. The pilot of the plane died in the crash, but the co-pilot survived. Rescue crews battled snow, slush, and river currents today to pull eight more bodies from the wreckage. New guidelines from the Public Health Service issued today call on doctors to aggressively treat urinary incontinence. This problem affects more than 10 million Americans. NPR's Patricia Naiman reports.
Federal health officials say that the vast majority of people who suffer from incontinence don't tell their doctors out of embarrassment or the belief that nothing can be done. As a result, most don't get treated. Health officials called on doctors to question patients more thoroughly about incontinence, to offer treatment options and referral to specialists. Officials note that today there are an increasing number of treatments that work, including exercises for bladder control, drug therapy, and surgery. Federal officials say at least 80% of those who now suffer from incontinence could be successfully treated if they tell their doctors about the problem. Incontinence is not limited to the elderly. In one study, at least one out of every four women between the ages of 30 and 59 said they, too, had suffered episodes of the problem. In Los Angeles, I'm Patricia Naiman reporting.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 4 points to close at 3,272.14 on volume of 157 million shares. Trading was moderate. This is NPR News. Prices are expected to be lifted in Moscow tomorrow on the last basic goods so far not affected. This move will include bread, salt, and sugar. Price controls on many consumer items were lifted in January as Russia moved toward a free market system. Western economists have called on the Russian government to lift all price controls, arguing it would stimulate supply, help the budget deficit, and increase the value of the ruble. Even with price controls, the price of milk has climbed more than 5 times this year, and sugar has been almost impossible to find. In Mexico City, dangerously high pollution levels in recent days have forced the government to take emergency measures. Sandina Robbins reports.
Car owners must leave their autos home 2 days a week now and on rotating weekends, or face a hefty fine of $136. This latest emergency measure began on Monday and is expected to continue for the next month. Previously, cars were taken off the road once a week, according to color-coded stickers. But when the pollution alarms went off last week, the government decided that one day was not enough. Major polluting industries in the city must also cut production by 30%. Yet according to the city's former environmental affairs director, only 5% of the factories operate with anti-pollution equipment. Mexico City's pollution has reached its limit, says Ramon Ojeda Mestre. There are no easy solutions, he said, and everyone will have to give up something. For National Public Radio, I'm Sandina Robbins in Mexico City.
NASA officials have now scheduled for tomorrow morning launch of the space shuttle Atlantis after liftoff this morning was canceled. Fuel leaks prompted a one-day delay, but officials say it's not the same problem that grounded shuttles for almost half a year in 1990. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. From James Cagney's classics to The Godfather, some of our best movies have been about gangsters. Movies have created our legends and fantasies about gangster life. The movie Bugsy is up for 10 Academy Awards next week, including Best Picture. Bugsy tells the story of how Benjamin Bugsy Siegel, with the financial help of Meyer Lansky, created the first luxury hotel casino in the Las Vegas desert. Although Bugsy was rubbed out before his hotel, the Flamingo, became a success, he opened the way for an industry that would eventually make gazillions of dollars. If the movie made you curious about the real stories of Bugsy, Lansky, and Vegas, you'll be interested in what Robert Lacey has to say. He's the author of the book Little Man, Meyer Lansky and the Gangster Life. Lacey is also the author of the bestseller The Kingdom about Saudi Arabia and books about Henry Ford and the British royal family. Let's get started with the movie portrayals of Bugsy and Lansky, as played by Warren Beatty and Ben Kingsley. In this scene, they're in the backseat of a car. The Flamingo has gone way over budget. The hotel and Bugsy are in big financial trouble.
The Flamingo's gonna come in at $6 million, Ben.
Listen, Meyer, anyone who tells you...
Ben, I'm on your side. I'm doing what I can. Stop trying to fool me and stop trying to fool yourself. Look, you need $3 million. If you can come up with $2 million, I can come up with one. Charlie knows nothing about this. This is between you and me. Can you come up with that kind of money?
No problem.
Would you stop that, please? Would you stop with the no problems? Think for a second. What are you going to do to get the money? You always protected me, Benny, when we were kids. You were always behind me. But I can't protect you.
My shares.
What about them?
I own a third of the hotel. I'll sell it.
That's all you've got, Ben. You'll end up with nothing. After all this, nothing.
But the Flamingo will be there. That's not nothing.
One of the things I was really surprised to read in your book was that Ben Siegel did not create the first big hotel casino in Las Vegas. There were already a couple there.
Yes, he went there in the middle of the Second World War to get involved in the bookmaking, which had just become legal in Nevada. And when he got there, there were already two very luxurious hotel resort casinos out on what is called the Strip. I mean, there's this great legend that, which we actually saw in the movie, that he was a sort of modern Mormon who strode out into the desert and said, here will rise shining palaces of chance, his sort of temples of blackjack and that sort of thing. And he dreamt it all up in his head. Well, he learnt it from what he saw, and the evidence shows very clearly that in 1943 he actually tried to buy one of the existing resort casinos that was there, called the Last Frontier. And even his own hotel, the Flamingo, which was so beautifully portrayed in the movie, that wasn't started by him, and it certainly, sadly, was not named after Virginia Hill's legs or anything like that. It was started by another man called Billy Wilkerson, who was quite a significant Beverly Hills figure. He really was involved in the starting of Sunset Strip and The Hollywood Reporter and all sorts of things, and he had the idea of bringing the Beverly Hills glitzy sort of atmosphere out to Las Vegas, which, although luxurious, had a sort of howdy partner, cowboy atmosphere to it. He started the Flamingo. Then he ran out of money, and it was only at that point that Bugsy Siegel came in with his partner's money, and then the rest is sort of history.
It would be interesting to mention, too, here that at the time Bugsy Siegel gets involved with Las Vegas, Mae West and Frank Sinatra were trying to start casinos, too. So it was already in the air by then.
Oh, yes. There's an article in one of the Las Vegas papers for that time saying everybody wants to start a hotel. Yes, Roy Rogers is going to start a dude ranch. The idea that, you know, Bugsy Siegel introduced Hollywood to Las Vegas is sadly not true.
You know, in the movie, Bugsy Siegel is portrayed as being occasionally psychotic. He lapses into psychotic frenzies when he's pushed too far or when you make the mistake of calling him Bugsy. From your research in real life, was Bugsy Siegel more consistently crazy than that?
No, I think that was very accurate, and I thought the way in which right at the beginning of the movie you see his rather more cold-blooded partners, Lucky Luciano and Maya Lansky, quietly waiting in the limo while he goes in to do what they know is violence. They just know he's going to lose his temper, and they're really exploiting his psychosis. From what I can see, that is very much the case. He boasted to the builder, Del Webb, that in the course of his life he'd killed a dozen people. Maya Lansky, talking about him in later years, while denying that he himself, Lansky, had ever killed anybody, said, "But you know, my friend Benny, well, he knocked off plenty."
How did Ben Siegel get the name of Bugsy, and why did he hate to be called it?
Well, we're not sure. This is buried back in the folklore of the Lower East Side. In the late 1920s, you do see reports in New York papers of something called the Bug and Maya Gang. Not Bugs, in fact, Bug and Maya Gang. And the story is that people said he's crazy as a bed bug, and naturally he himself didn't like this. I mean, there's no doubt at all, we can tell from the photographs, that Benny Siegel was a very fastidious dresser. He loved these wonderful sports jackets with houndstooth check and sharp ties and all that sort of thing. And the idea of being called, being likened to an insect, and being essentially demeaned by the nickname, I can see that it would annoy him. This is another thing I found. You know, we associate all these gangsters with nicknames, you know, Bugs and Fatsy and that sort of thing. But actually, when you look at it, it's the newspapers who coin these phrases and who use them. And, you know, from what one hears on wiretaps or sees in transcripts of wiretaps, the characters themselves don't use this. I think it's another example of the way in which we on the outside embroider all this and sort of putting these desperados in the tradition of Billy the Kid and giving them nicknames.
That's interesting, you know, because I've been wondering why Meyer Lansky never had a nickname that was really used. I mean, the book is called Little Man, and I know he might have been known by that, but it's not what he was popularly known.
No. Well, Meyer Lansky was very different from Ben Siegel. And here again, I thought that Ben Kingsley's depiction of Lansky in the movie was brilliant. I mean, I was wondering how Gandhi was going to play Meyer Lansky. And I just thought it was superb. I mean, you got the fine combination of the loyalty and affection that he obviously felt for his mad friend. And they suggest a reason for it, that when they were kids, Benny had protected him, and that's quite a plausible sort of supposition, combined with this hard head for figures and the ability to, you know, keep everything in his head and be the detached businessman. And it was because, of course, he was the detached businessman that Lansky's outlived all the others.
My guest is Robert Lacey, author of a book about Bugsy Siegel and Meyer Lansky. We'll talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Just joining us, my guest is Robert Lacey, author of the new book Little Man, Meyer Lansky and the Gangster Life. What were Meyer Lansky's rules of business? You know, he was known as someone who was more involved with the business end of the mob rather than the the physically violent part.
That's
which
right.
Which isn't to say he wasn't behind it, but I mean he wasn't the strongman kind of guy. No. He started off
as a young tough, as all gangsters do, and he worked as a starker, strong arm man, protecting crap games, getting involved in union disputes. He always used to say, you know, I only ever beat up the blacklegs, the scabs. I never, I was always on the workers' side. But, you know, he did come from a violent background, but he very soon saw that if he was to survive and if he was to make any money, he had to disassociate himself from that. He had to stand back. And he became the brains of the various syndicates he was involved in, the accountant, if you like. And he brought to this two particular gifts. I mean, one was a mastery of figures. In all his life, he only spent a couple of months in jail in Saratoga on a gaming conviction. And I went to Saratoga. I found the man who was in jail with him. And he said that, you know, he and Meyer spent their days in jail doing sums. And I said, well, what do you mean sums? And he said, well, I would write down blocks of digits, 8 or 9 by 8 or 9, and Meyer would run his finger up and down, just like a calculator, and reel off the answer. And I'd say, you know, I think you got it wrong. And Meyer said, no, you check it. And he'd always had it right. And of course, in that business, the ability to keep the figures in your head, not to have anything on paper, is very important. And the other thing Lansky brought to crime, and this may sound paradoxical, was a strange sort of honesty. Gangsters are businessmen in their peculiar way, in their sort of parody of the businessman. They're entrepreneurs, and like every entrepreneur, they live for the dividend. And when they get together on a Friday or Saturday to split up the latest racket they've been involved in, someone has to handle the share out. And the trouble is that most crooks are crooks, and the people who do it put a few thousand in their own pocket and then tell some story about a police chief who had to be bought off or whatever. And everybody goes home disappointed and not quite getting what they expected. And that, of course, is when the trouble starts, the vendettas, the killings and so on. Now, with Lansky, that never happened because Lansky was not personally a greedy man. He never took too much for himself. So everybody left a share out with Meyer Lansky, knowing the sums were right and the shares were honest. And people came back for more. People liked working with Meyer, and they got more experience and more trust. And so his syndicates grew and developed a reputation. But it was all based on this paradox that at the center of a successful criminal enterprise, you need someone honest.
One of the focal points of gangster lore is the relationship between Lucky Luciano and Meyer Lansky. Was it unusual for someone Jewish like Meyer Lansky and someone Italian like Lucky Luciano to have a collaborative relationship together?
I don't think it was. I mean, there was a movie last year called Mobsters, which treated the coming together of the young Italians and the young Jews as if it was a sort of peace in the Middle East. In fact, they had a lot in common. They were both new immigrant groups. They were living side by side. They had, in fact, much more in common against the WASP establishment and against the Irish than there was to divide them. And, the common picture of organized crime in America is an Italian one. But if you were to look at it in the early 1920s, you would have said it was a Jewish one. I mean, the great boss, crime boss of New York, was Arnold Rothstein, the notorious figure involved in the Fixing of the World series. There were people like Meyer Lansky, Bugsy Siegel, Waxy Gordon. Dutch Schultz, in fact, was not Jewish, although people think he was. Arthur Flegenheimer, he was German and not German-Jewish. And these Jewish gangsters were not just brains like Lansky and money men. I mean, they were tough. They were tough like Bugsy Siegel. And the most notorious bunch of all, which were called Murder Incorporated by the newspapers, were run by Lepke Buchalter and Mendy Weiss. And they were Jewish hitmen. And I was told by cops and people who remember those days in New York that in the time of the Italian gang wars in 1929, 1930, that the Italians would actually enlist Jews to do the killing. And so the modern stereotypes of all gangsters being Italian certainly wasn't the case back in the heyday of the gangster.
Robert Lacey is the author of Little Man, Meyer Lansky and the Gangster Life. This is Fresh Air.
Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, news today of Libya's offer to hand over the two Libyans suspected and accused of a role in the Lockerbie bombing to the Arab League, which presumably would then be able to hand them over to any other judicial body that would put the men on trial. They've been indicted by the U.S. and Britain for their roles, alleged roles in the bombing. Also today, we'll be hearing about Kenya's generation of talented young runners. Daniel Zwerdling reports on them, even tries to run with them a little bit, I hear. And we'll also be hearing about projects that pro- and anti-abortion groups are actually finding they can work together on.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Berry Gordy and the success of Motown are usually held up as a milestone in the history of black-owned record labels. Not to take away from Gordy, but he was hardly the first, nor was his operation the most long-lived. In 1951, Bobby Robinson started operating out of a small record shop next to the Apollo Theater in Harlem. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward says Robinson's career lasted long enough for him to record some of the first rap records. But when he started out, the sound he went after was more like this.
Robinson opened Bobby's Records in 1946 and, probably because of his great location, immediately became the man to see in Harlem for the latest music. After 5 years of doing unpaid consultation for others, he decided to start his own record label, and so Red Robin Records was formed, specializing in R&B records like this one we're hearing, Red Prysock Wiggles, and eventually recording some of the first New York doo-wop records.
The closer you are, the brighter the stars in the sky. And darling, I realize you're the one in my life. Oh, my heart.
He didn't really start to taste success, though, until 1956, when he formed the Whirlin' Disc label and recorded the Channel's The Closer You Are, a milestone in New York vocal harmony history. After that, there was the controversial Desiree by the Charts, a song that sounded like they were making it up as they went along, and a raft of others that are mostly of interest to collectors. Robinson knew something else was about to break, though, and in 1959, he nudged it along. Only somebody as closely in touch with the street as Bobby Robinson could have known that there existed in the hearts of urban black people a nostalgia for down home, which translated into a market for gritty blues. Wilbert Harrison's Kansas City was a novelty that became a pop hit, and Robinson, who'd grown up in rural South Carolina, had a knack for finding blues records like that.
Well, I won't say-
Buster Brown was 45 when he had a hit with Fannie Mae, and Elmore James was 42 when Robinson revived his career with a song that had some of the most dramatic lyrics any Chicago blues man had ever sung, The Sky Is Crying. The fact that records like this sold so well in 1960 was nothing short of amazing. Robinson was riding high, and next he headed to New Orleans to sign up talent. Bobby Marchand's There's Something on Your Mind was a spooky tale of murdering your girlfriend and asking her forgiveness as she died, while the other hit he picked up was taken from a children's game.
Oh, well, I'm sitting here la-la waiting for my ya-ya. Oh, I'm sitting here la-la waiting for my ya-ya. Oh, it may sound funny, but I don't believe she's coming. Oh.
Ya-ya started Lee Dorsey's career, which continued through the 70s, and back home in New York, Robinson launched another famous singer at almost the same time.
In every beat of my heart, there's a beat for you.
Year-old Gladys Knight had been singing with her brother and her cousins for 10 years by the time Every Beat of My Heart came out on Robinson's Fury Records in 1961, and she's still going strong. In 1962, Robinson started a label called Enjoy to give a saxophone player he'd worked with a chance at a solo record. Curtis's soul twist brought him up front after countless R&B sessions and started him off, but Enjoy was a label that would have a very interesting history. Robinson more or less sat the 60s out in his record store, and he hated disco, but one afternoon in the mid-70s, he caught his nephew writing something in the living room. Rap? Robinson had never heard of it, but it had the same feeling as doo-wop, so in 1979, he took some kids into a garage and started the next phase of his career.
Way we rock the house, sure enough, everybody gonna turn it out.
Well, I'm kicking rock well, cause the rock so swell. Every time you hear my name, it rings a bell.
Well, I'm Lady Rodney C, making history with all the fly girls yelling, take me.
Well, I'm Star Rock, and I can't be stopped, for all the fly guys gonna hit the top.
Well, I'm Keith Keith, but you can call me Keith Caesar. The reason why, cause I'm the women pleaser.
Well, I'm Jazzy Jeff.
These days, Robinson is semi-retired, running his store and writing his memoirs. Now, there's a book that should have some history in it.
Ed Ward writes for the Austin Chronicle. Today we welcome our former associate producer Roberta Shurrock into the director's chair. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a talk with one of Israel's most highly regarded novelists, A.B. Yehoshua. His family has lived in Israel for six generations. His new novel spans six generations of one Jewish family's history. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.